Hi, this is Alan Carrington again, and with me today is Jeff Scott. Jeff, you were recently at the University of Adelaide Learning and Teaching Festival, but you're from the University of Western Sydney, and thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure, Alan.
We're doing this on Skype for those that are listening, which is Jeff sitting in his office in Sydney. I'm in Adelaide. Jeff, tell me what you do at the University of Western Sydney. Please.
My current job, I'm about to retire, in fact, Alan, but for the last 18 months, I've been Executive Director of Sustainability at UWS, building up a strategic approach to it across the curriculum, research, operations and engagement activities in the university. But prior to that, I was Pro Vice Chancellor Quality for about 8 years here.
Tremendous. What do you, at the risk of starting a whole new episode on sustainability, what do you mean by sustainability in education?
Well, basically what we're doing now in the regional centres of expertise in this area around the world, there's 100 of those. Basically, we define sustainability in education, particularly higher education, as having four pillars that interact with one another, and those pillars are social, cultural, economic and environmental sustainability. So there are four pillars, and those four pillars are seen to interact with the four key activities of a university, which is research, teaching, engagement and operations. So you can imagine a matrix of possibilities there.
Oh, absolutely, and we could maybe do another podcast. I want to come focusing on these things you introduced at the Learning and Teaching Festival. These, you introduced them as the top 15 capabilities at a meeting you had recently at the time. Can you tell me what that's about?
Yes, those top 15 capabilities are the ones identified from an international project we've been undertaking for the Australian government over the last 18 months around the world, where we've looked at successful leaders of sustainability in universities, 188 of them around the world, and tried to identify from them as effective practitioners what they think are the capabilities that count that have led them to get some effective action in those four pillars that I mentioned earlier and the four activities.
Yeah, incredible. Providing Skype doesn't get degraded, I think we're okay, but yell and we can restart and I can edit. But I'm going to list all those capabilities in the blog entry, of course, Jeff. But to be honest with you, it was a major aha because at the risk of trying to get a label around it, it seems to me that they're more of the heart than they're of the head.
Yes. And just before I respond to that insight, which is absolutely spot on, we've been doing this research for 20 years now. So we started by looking at what are the capabilities that successful skill Olympians identified, Australian skill Olympians, and we started that back in about 1992. We then proceeded to do the same thing by identifying successful early career graduates in 10 different professions, everything from nursing to sports management to IT, engineering, architecture, journalism, teaching. We then proceeded from that to look at these successful leaders in universities and try and map the capabilities. So first of all, we did successful academic leaders all the way from Deputy Vice Chancellor to Program Head. Then we did successful professional leaders all the way from Deputy Vice Chancellor Corporate to a local manager. And then we did the study I just mentioned to you at the outset here, the one on leaders of sustainability. I wanted to mention that to you because those 15 capabilities that you're putting on the blog essentially come up in every single one of those studies. So if you take the 10 professions of early successful early career graduates, they are very similar in the valence given to them. There's about 40 items that make up our framework, and the top 15 are the ones that you'll be putting on your blog. Now, back to your question with that context in mind, that what you've been talking about is what we've discovered is precisely that emotional intelligence, personal and interpersonal capabilities, we call them, but, you know, people like Goleman in the 90s called it emotional intelligence, always rate up in the top 15 in a disproportionate number. Usually 10 to 12 of the top 15 are about emotional intelligence, like empathizing with people, being able to remain calm when things go wrong, being aware of your strengths and weaknesses, listening to others rather than to your own ego, being able to manage mad people and diversity, not just your own sort of in-group. All of these are seen to be the key capabilities for managing effective practice, particularly when things start to go wrong, because in a sense we're mostly tested actually when things go wrong, not when things go right. So that's why they're so important. The other thing to say about that top 15 when folk look at them is you'll see there's always a few cognitive capabilities sitting there, but those aren't the ones that you tend to see listed in university websites as the key attributes for graduates. They're actually more about being able to diagnose what's going on in a complex human as well as technical situation. And then underpinning those as necessary but not sufficient are some profession-specific skills, but also some generic skills. Now, the problem is that if we are finding this as successful fellow travellers just walking down the path and doing well are telling us this is what counts, then, of course, the issue is what are we doing about that in the 21st century university?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do you see the mapping of all this this feedback from all these different courses that university graduate attributes have emerged or should emerge?
Yeah, I mean, this is very interesting and very important in the current context with the introduction of the Tertiary Education Quality and Standards Agency, TEQSA, because TEQSA is very interested in outcomes. And indeed, the country is interested in outcomes. So if you want to be a successful, resilient, adaptable, ethically robust country in a world, you know, that's constantly throwing up challenges, right, just as it happens at the personal level, then the universities, in my humble view, for the 21st century, have a key role to try and develop the people who are capable of managing in that rapidly shifting context, which we should be getting much sharper about validating the outcomes and the attributes listed on websites. And that is precisely in the agenda of what the text of the Tertiary Education Quality and Standards Agency is increasingly focused to anyway.
Okay, I'm a passionate teacher, and I'm sitting here looking at this feedback from the industry leaders in my discipline. What do I do about it? What could I do about it? Is it only an institutional change thing, or can teachers do something about this?
Well, there's TEQSA, the Tertiary Education Quality and Standards Agency. Area 3 is about quality and standards for learning and teaching. So one of the key components of that framework as it's emerging, which will then affect every teacher in every university, is tell us what you're doing to validate the outcomes that you're giving focus to in these particular programs you're running, whether it's medicine, architecture, teaching, it doesn't matter. Because that agenda is there, then the issue is how do we know we are actually picking the outcomes that will count for a robust country in the 21st century, which then leads us back to why not, as one source of data, start to actually look in each professional area at what successful early career graduates say are the capabilities they know have been most important for them to make their way through the inevitable challenges of being a professional as a doctor or an architect or an engineer, it doesn't matter. So the short answer for you as a teacher is it makes it much more relevant for your students, it makes it much more relevant for you as a teacher if you would have the data from hundreds of successful early career graduates, people identified as successful by their employers, clients and colleagues, it's the way you do it, and backward mapping from that to what you're giving focus to in your assessment, but also in the sorts of programs that you're using.
Yeah.
The assessment.
That's right. And as a learning designer, I'm really interested to know what sort of activities I could build inside a course that helps students practice giving credit to others.
Yeah.
Well, how do I do that? I mean, that's a huge professional development opportunity or need here, is there not?
Well, but it's also what we know empirically, because another set of research I've done for many years is looking at the comments that students make on the course experience questionnaire. They write a best aspect and needs improvement comment, and we've analysed about 1.2 million of them now, and what we find when we look at that, the things that they identify as a best aspect is what all good teachers know anyway, is people learn by doing.
Yep.
They actually learn by being immersed in real-world problems that they know people like them who are out there in the first early years of their career are encountering. They love the idea of actually being cast into a situation where they have to, first of all, work out what's going on. That's that diagnostic intelligence. Then utilize the human beings in the situation to check what the diagnosis might be and what to do about it. All of this is then, of course, what's been common for decades is problem-based learning, centered around real-world challenges identified by the graduates that you actually interview to actually get a priority for the capabilities that are most important. So the first teaching tool, first cab off the rank, confirmed by 1.2 million students, is real-world problem-based learning of people like me who are out in the early career practice, number one. Number two, going on practicum. So if it's possible for people to actually go out and when they're on practicum, to have the person who is supervising them know what the top 15 capabilities are for that specific profession for the early career graduates as a doctor, a nurse, a teacher, and to be observing them when things go wrong and to see the extent to which they have practiced the top 15 capabilities. What you've then got is learning in the context of the practicum using a properly valenced set of checkpoints.
Yes.
By successful travellers as the top 15.
It also says to me as a learning designer that one of the emerging pedagogies that will gain a huge importance is situational learning or scenario-based learning and yep. Simulations.
Exactly. I'll give you an example, right? I applied to do medicine at University of Newcastle in about 1982 or 1983. So I took the train up and I got into a hall up there, and there's two or three, four stages of getting in. This is the master medical model. This is way back in 1982, 83. We sat in a hall and there were 400 or 500 people applying to get in. They put a video up on the screen, and the video was a general practitioner sitting in an office. And outside of the office in the waiting room was a young mother, vivacious young mum with two kids, coming in to get the results of her most recent mammography, right?
Yep.
They then cut to the GP. The GP is looking at the results and they're very bad. She's got secondaries and basically it's not going to be operable. They stopped the video there and all 500 people were asked to write down how would you handle a situation with the woman who's about to come in? And you write that up.
Yep.
They collected it up. Then they showed the second half of the video. And you then were asked to critique the efficacy with which that GP had broken the news.
Right.
Now that's using IT as it was in 1982, if you can see what I'm saying
here.
The closer you can get to that pit of the stomach feeling when Mr. Cockups come to visit, as it were, if you know what I mean? When things are going wrong, and the more you're going to actually give people practice in how to manage themselves when things go wrong. And then isn't it wonderful if you did all of that and then you had some fellow travellers who'd handled that situation successfully, telling you what they did?
Absolutely. This is really close to my heart, Jeff, and we've been talking now for 17, 18 minutes. I'm going to wrap it up only because maybe we could do another one, even if it's at another time. There's just so much in this thing. You've been particularly encouraging to me because one of the things I'm about to do is go to America to learn new skills in a whole area of simulations and situational learning. That providing my health is okay, but that's another whole story. Look. Thank you for your time, Jeff. It's been an absolute pleasure and downright enlightening. Thank you for your time.
Thanks very much, Alan, and all the very best to you.